Food Today, science-based information on food, nutrition and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council. The second International Vitamin Conference, held between the 23rd and 25th of May 2012 in Copenhagen, brought together scientists and regulators in sharing new knowledge on vitamins. Arranged by the Technical University of Denmark, the discussion of the conference was focused on 13 vitamins from food and supplements, the content, their activity, biomarkers, and optimal dietary intake. To share some insights, UFIC interviewed five key speakers on their respective areas of research on vitamins, including vitamin K, folate, vitamin B12, and vitamin C. Dr. Bruce Ames, previously the chair of biochemistry at the University of California in Berkeley, and now a senior scientist at the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute in the United States, presented the recently developed triage theory, which links an inadequate intake of vitamins and minerals to age-related disease. He explains.
You require about 15 minerals to run your metabolism and about 15 vitamins, roughly. And committees get together and set how much they think we need. But all the thinking is short-term, and what I'm going to tell you is I think we have to rethink everything and change to long-term. What we've postulated, and now we've really shown, that when you're getting a little low on any of these 30 vitamins or minerals, what's built into your metabolism is that the proteins that need that particular vitamin, for example, and are essential for survival and reproduction, those proteins hold it. But the proteins that are more long-term, that, for example, protect against DNA damage or protect against heart disease, those proteins lose it. So it's a trade-off between short-term survival and long-term health.
Can you describe some of the evidence which supports the triage theory of aging?
So my colleague Joyce McCann wrote two beautiful reviews, one looking at vitamin K. We didn't do any of the work. That was done by wonderful scientists in Holland and in Boston. So vitamin K you get from your greens. You don't eat greens, you're not getting your vitamin K. And it's necessary for coagulation proteins to work. And those proteins are essential. If you cut yourself and you didn't have coagulation proteins, you'd bleed to death. The price you pay is you disable osteocalcin, which is a protein in the bone that's moving calcium around in the bone. And you make bones, but they crack easily. And associated with vitamin K deficiency is bone fractures. And you knock the gene out in mice, you stress them a bit, their bones break. And you also knock out matrix GLA protein, which again needs vitamin K to make it. And the animals are born, they look okay, and then they all drop dead of calcification of the arteries. This protein stops calcification of the arteries. These are all calcium-binding proteins. So we understand mechanism, and the epidemiology fits with all of this. And you can look in the human gene, and there's a rare mutation where people get calcification of the arteries in an early age and die. My colleague Joyce McCann analyzed selenium, and that metabolism uses a different system to accomplish the same end, but the proteins essential for survival get priority and the other ones get disabled if you don't have enough. About half the proteins we looked at were involved with keeping you to have a long life, and the other half were essential for survival and reproduction. And what that also predicts there's going to be a whole new class of vitamins and minerals we haven't discovered, because all our discovery of vitamins and minerals has been based on short-term things.
Nutritional survey data show many people have low intakes of vitamins. How can we act on this?
The committees set the standards. It's called an EAR. If you're below that, they say you're not getting it. You're inadequate. You're deficient. Now, serious disease comes when you're really low. Then you get If you get too little vitamin C, you get scurvy and your teeth fall out and you die. But moderate vitamin C deficiency, we're talking about 30% of the U.S. population. They're not getting enough vitamin C. Vitamin C is in citrus, it's in peppers. If you're not eating your veggies, you're in trouble. You really should eat more veggies. It's for a healthy diet. You need the fiber and you need all the vitamins in veggies. People are worried about a part per billion of some pesticide. That's all a distraction from the important things that are killing us, which is our bad diets are aging us faster. In northern climates, most northerners aren't getting enough vitamin D. Now, vitamin D you mostly don't get from your food. If you eat a lot of seafood, you can get some vitamin D. But vitamin D comes from sunshine, ultraviolet light and sunshine. So you need some ultraviolet light to convert 7-dehydrocholesterol in your skin to the precursor of vitamin D. And vitamin D goes to a hormone, calcitriol, that's turning on 900 genes in the brain and all sorts of important functions in your body. So you don't get enough vitamin D, you're in deep trouble, particularly for the brain. And in the United States, we have dark-skinned people, the African Americans, in a northern climate. So you put an Irishman in Australia, they're in deep trouble. And the solution is a hat and sunscreen. You put an African American in Chicago, they're in deep trouble. And the solution is a pill of vitamin D that costs a few cents. So it's cheap. So overall then, the advice is if you don't get enough sunshine or you're a dark-skinned person, you have to really make sure you test your vitamin D and get up to the right level.
As a scientist, how would you respond to the negative media about vitamins?
Well, there have been a few really bad studies, one from the Mayo Clinic, that drew all sorts of conclusions about vitamins don't do any good, and they're poorly designed. And there have been critiques of them. There's a very good one on the Linus Pauling Institute website, and there's Walter Willett has criticized it severely. The best people in the world think that's an awful study, or at least way overinterpreted. And the nutrition literature says that we know that vitamins are important for your metabolism. People aren't getting enough. We're just ignoring all these committees. And even that is all based on short term. When we think about long term, we may need even more. We don't know. A note of warning. If you tell people selenium's good for them, 5% of people are going to go out and poison themselves by eating too much selenium. Minerals in particular, the metals, are tricky because metals are small and they look a lot like each other. So calcium and magnesium are very similar. If you take a calcium pill, you should be taking a calcium-magnesium pill. Because too much calcium will disable some magnesium enzymes and vice versa. And potassium and sodium are a pair like that. So you have to be careful. Don't overload yourself with salt and not eat your veggies. Some of the B vitamins, you have a big window. It's hard to get too much. But the metals, you have to be very careful.
Dr. Sarah Booth from the Jean Mayer USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging at Tufts University in the United States was one of a group of experts convened to examine whether there's a need to develop separate dietary reference values for a form of vitamin K, vitamin K2, also known as menaquinones. Sarah shared the group's findings with us.
There's been a lot of popular press about the beneficial effects of menaquinones. When the committee convened, we reviewed the literature, and what we found was that there are a few foods that menaquinones are found in. They're produced by bacteria, so they're found in foods that are fermented, like cheese, fermented soybeans, which is the common food in Japan. However, overall, compared to other vitamins, we really don't have a good database for how much this vitamin is in the food supply. So at the moment, we've concluded that we can't do estimates of how much the average person consumes.
What do we know about what happens to vitamin K2 in the body?
When we reviewed the way this form of vitamin K was used in the body, we compared it to the form that we know a lot more about, which is vitamin K1 or phylloquinone, which you find in green leafy vegetables and plant oils. And we know quite a bit about phylloquinone absorption. But we realize compared to phyloquinone, we don't know a lot about vitamin K2 absorption. The only data that are available would suggest that it's taken up by the body more readily than the form you get in plants, and it hangs around in circulation more than the form you get in plants, but we really don't know what that translates into. Again, we concluded that we needed really more research on how does the body handle this form of vitamin K when you consume it from these fermented foods. The next point of study that the group conducted was to look at the comparative roles of menaquinones and health outcomes compared to phyloquinone. And the first area we looked at was the role of menaquinones or vitamin K2 on prevention of vascular calcification. And the reasoning behind that is that there are certain proteins that live in the walls of your vessels that require vitamin K for function. And as best as the evidence shows right now, any form of vitamin K you eat will serve that function. So these proteins, what they do is they sit there waiting for calcium to be in the vessels, and then they grab onto the calcium, and then they prevent the calcium from continuing. So we see it as once you form a plaque in your arteries, these proteins, if you have enough vitamin K, will actually stop the plaque from being more calcified. So when we looked at the evidence, it looks like when you eat menaquinones, there's an association with lower risk for getting calcification. Now, we always have to remember these are observational studies. So generally, people eat these kinds of food, generally have lower vascular calcification, and that doesn't mean one causes the other, but it's very suggestive of future research.
So vitamin K may be good for cardiovascular health. Is vitamin K also important for other health outcomes?
There's proteins in bone that, similar to the vessel walls, are sitting there waiting for vitamin K to come by to create this change to those proteins. It's only vitamin K can cause change in those proteins, and as a result, when they've got the vitamin K independent change, they bind to the calcium. The prevailing thought is that these proteins will prevent bone loss in the elderly. The evidence is weak but suggestive. So there are some studies that would suggest that those people who have high consumption of these foods actually have less bone loss. However, there have been no clinical trials that have been published to date that have tested the hypothesis. When you compare the phyloquinone and the menaquinones for these health outcomes such as bone and vascular calcification, there's some suggestion that they both have an effect, but we've just never done the studies to compare the two forms, the form you get from plants and the form you get from fermented foods. The committee concluded that while there are differences in the way the body handles the menaquinones compared to phyloquinone, and they definitely come from different food sources, and there appears to be a difference in how the body handles them. Right now, we simply don't have enough data to support developing a separate recommendation for menaquinone. Right now, the recommendations for vitamin K are exclusively based on the phyloquinone, which is the plant-based form. But even for phyloquinone, which is being the subject of most study, we really don't have any biomarkers that can be linked to a disease yet. All our recommendations for phyloquinone intake are based on the average amounts people eat in the diet. The requirements don't take into account the menaquinones. So one of the conclusions of the committee was we really need to have this paradigm shift in how we view vitamin requirements. Even though we don't have a lot of data right now to justify a separate requirement for menaquinones, we at least, when we develop the requirements for vitamin K, need to focus on phyloquinone and the other forms.
What about vitamin K dietary supplements?
Right now, our requirements, our recommendations, are based on what you actually eat from food. Having said that, there are certain populations, in particularly patients, who can't obtain those amounts from foods for whatever reason, they may have a physiological condition that prevents them from absorbing. They may not be able to eat certain foods, etc. And for those individuals, my personal opinion is that supplements serve a purpose because they supplement what you can't get from the diet to the amount that you are recommended to take. I don't believe that excessive supplementation, which means taking it way above that is recommended in the diet, is warranted at this point for vitamin K, for the simple reason we haven't done the trials to show the benefits of high amounts. Having said that, there's no evidence at this point that very, very high amounts of vitamin K causes any adverse effects.
Barry Shane, a professor of nutritional sciences and toxicology at the University of California in Berkeley, California, in the United States, gave us an overview of the important role of folate for health.
In the early 1990s, a study by the MRC in London showed that given women who previously had a child with a birth defect, folic acid greatly reduced the incidence or reoccurrence of this disease. So it was a very dramatic discovery, and the reason for this even now is not known, but up to 80% of the major birth defects can be prevented if women receive folic acid in the first 3 weeks of pregnancy. Public health messages to women that they should do this were not very successful, and many women don't realize they're pregnant until after the period when they need folic acid. So in the US in the mid-1990s, they decided to fortify the food supply with folic acid to make sure that women got enough folic acid in early pregnancy. This was somewhat controversial because this is the first instance of fortifying the food supply with a nutrient, not because the food supply was deficient in the nutrient, but to actually treat a clinical condition.
Have folic acid fortification programs been effective?
The fortification program has been very effective in the US and also in the over 50 other countries that now fortify the food supply with folic acid. The incidence of birth defects, neurotube defects, has greatly decreased, and particularly so in areas where there was a high incidence of these diseases. In some high incidence areas, the incidence of birth defects has gone down by 86%, which is a very dramatic effect. This fortification is basically to ensure that women who are capable of having a pregnancy have sufficient folate in early pregnancy. It also is affecting the rest of the population. So in some regards, this has been helpful for the rest of the population. The incidence of folate deficiency in the US decreased from 20% to less than 1% after fortification in all age groups. The levels of homocysteine, which some believe may be a risk factor for vascular disease, have been reduced from 20% of people with elevated homocysteine to less than 10% with elevated homocysteine. There have been some concerns raised that high folate may have an adverse effect on cancer rates. And this has not been proven by any means, but there is some logic to the idea that high folate may be affecting cancer rates. We know that folate antagonists have been used effectively for treating cancer, because folate is involved in DNA replication and repair. And we also know from very many epidemiological studies that if people are deficient in folate, they have a higher risk of developing cancer. What the concern is right now is if someone has a pre-existing cancer, taking high levels of folate may speed up the development of the cancer. And this potential risk is why some countries have not introduced fortification programs.
How do we balance the potential risks with the benefits?
Of course, from a public health point of view, you would not want to recommend that people become folate deficient just to ensure that if they have a pre-existing cancer, it won't grow faster. The evidence really is that having poor folate status actually increases your chance of getting the cancer, or at least your risk of getting various cancers. And the evidence that high levels of folate intake actually speed up cancer development has a logic to it, but it's by no means proven. And so there are concerns that those segments of the population who are not at risk for having a kid with a neurotube defect may be receiving too high levels of folate is something that can't be totally eliminated right now. But for most people, actually having more folate has the potential of being in many ways beneficial. There is an upper limit for folic acid, and that's 1 milligram, and that's based on masking of B12 deficiency. A small percentage, maybe a few percent of the US population, is estimated to receive more than 1 milligram of folic acid a day. This upper limit is really not due to a toxic effect of folic acid, it's to prevent the masking of the symptoms of B12 deficiency. That is why in the US and many other countries, the level of fortification chosen to reduce the risk of having a child with a birth defect was not the optimal level for that reduction, but was to prevent most neurotube defects and at the same time not mask B12 deficiency.
Why is folic acid used? Is natural folate as effective?
There's a whole range of folate derivatives, and the one that is normally supplied in supplements or is used to fortify the food in some countries is folic acid. Folic acid itself is an unnatural form of the vitamin because it's not found in nature, but the reason why it's been used for many years for supplements is because it's a very stable form of the vitamin and it's easy to add to foods. There are some stable forms of the naturally occurring vitamins now available that are sometimes used in supplement preparations. Because the initial studies, the clinical intervention trials, were so successful with folic acid, it's really unethical to repeat these trials with other forms of folate or to test other nutrients without using folic acid. The supposition is that you don't absolutely require folic acid. Any other form of naturally occurring folate would work just as well. But unfortunately, that's never been proven. It's just what people believe right now.
Ebba Nexø, a professor of clinical biochemistry from the Aarhus University Hospital in Denmark, presented the story behind vitamin B12.
It was really discovered because of patients suffering from dreadful disease, eventually leading to their deaths because of severe anemia. But once it was discovered that they could be cured by eating lots of raw liver, one had a clue to identifying the active compound, which turned out actually to be vitamin B12. The severe anemia originally leading to the discovery of the vitamin is something to be concerned of, but it's not that common. And this condition is most often discovered before you really get very sick out of it. So the important thing is to know that a poor vitamin B12 status or even deficiency may cause a wide range of neurological symptoms, going all the way from feeling funny movements in your fingers to dementia, to infertility, and a number of other vague neurological complaints. So if you have such complaints, you might want to discuss with your doctor whether you should be examined for your vitamin B12 status. Do people normally get enough of the vitamin? The answer is yes, if you eat a healthy, balanced diet. But since the vitamin is only present in dietary sources of animal origin, you are in risk of not getting enough of the vitamin if you have a poorly vegetarian or even vegan diet. So if that's the case, you should be concerned about having an additional vitamin pill in order to get a sufficient amount of the vitamin. Those not really able to digest the food in order to liberate the vitamin B12, or lacking one of the factors within the gastrointestinal tract that is needed in order to absorb the vitamin. And that will most often be amongst the elderly people. Today, there's a big concern whether elderly individuals do get the amount of the vitamin that they should, and if they can benefit from supplementations from the point of view whether they are really capable of absorbing the vitamin. From the studies we have done, we have shown that the latter concern is perhaps not so important, that most people are able to absorb the vitamin if given in the form of a vitamin pill. So now you can ask the question whether you can get too much of the vitamin. If you suffer from the originally vitamin B12 deficiency disease, where you cannot absorb the vitamin because of a lack of the protein needed in order to get it from the stomach and into the bloodstream, then you need very high doses of the vitamin. And this is considered totally safe, because if you give such individuals up to 1 milligram of the vitamin daily, they will only absorb around 1% of the dose, which is quite close to the amount that an average person will get through their food stuff. We don't really know whether people capable of absorbing the vitamin will get symptoms if they have surplus vitamin B12. There are a few studies out there suggesting that this could result in an increased risk of cancer, but we still need to do a lot of studies to confirm this, and we still need to do some thinking as whether it's more beneficial than risky to get a supplement of vitamin B12. Folate and vitamin B12 collaborate from the point of view of ensuring a normal blood production. If you get a lot of folate, you might not develop an impaired blood production, and then you might not discover that you suffer from B12 deficiency. The problem is that it will be difficult to ensure a sufficient amount of B12 to all individuals by fortification, because as I explained, those really suffering from vitamin B12 deficiency will need huge doses of the vitamin. And I don't think currently we have sufficient information to make a decision.
Over what period of time does a deficiency of vitamin B12 develop?
If you go from being an omnivorous eater and choose to go on a vegetarian or a vegan diet, how long time will pass before you start to develop signs and symptoms of B12 impaired status? And the general understanding is that that's really years before that will happen. If you ask whether you can detect symptoms before you have serious neurological symptoms, that's the difficulties. And I think the only way nowadays you can do so is really by getting the idea that you might have an insufficient B12 status. And then in general terms, the biomarkers that we can measure in plasma will be very likely to indicate an insufficient status prior to you yourself having certain symptoms of a deficiency. The natural next question would be, should everyone be screened for a B12 deficiency or an impaired B12 status? And the problem there is that, as for most biomarkers, they are not perfect. They are indicative. Interpretate the biomarkers in the context of your situation. To conclude, I should state that most people eating a balanced diet do get the B12 that they need. But amongst the elderly, there might be a need for supplementation, and you need to be aware of a possible vitamin B12 insufficiency.
Jens Lagersfeldt, Professor of Experimental Pharmacology and Toxicology at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, presented the role of vitamin C in brain development and function. Can you summarize your research and what you found?
Well, basically, our main interest has been in vitamin C deficiency. It seems that quite a few people, and we're talking substantial proportions of the general population, actually suffers from various nutritional deficiencies. And our interest is specifically in vitamin C deficiency, which is extremely common and probably affects about between 5 to 30% of the Western populations. So our research is going into both human studies, or in particular animal studies, and we're using the guinea pig as an animal model, since guinea pigs, like humans, are unable to synthesize vitamin C and therefore can serve as a good animal model. So we've done tons of studies on vitamin C in guinea pigs, and several of them have been focusing on the brain and the brain development in particular in young individuals. We have found that vitamin C deficiency at a level that does not lead to any kind of clinical disease actually prones this individual to oxidative stress in the brain. Oxidative stress is a term used to characterize an imbalance between oxidants and antioxidants in the body. You can say that you have a redox imbalance. And this redox imbalance has been put into connection with tons of chronic diseases in humans, such as atherosclerosis, diabetes, cancer, and aging in general. Firstly, we have shown that vitamin C deficiency leads to oxidative stress in the brain, and subsequently we have tried to see if this also have functional and pathological consequences to the brain of developing animals. From our animal experiments, I would have to say yes. We have shown that in subclinical deficiency in guinea pig pups, you find a 30% less neuron count in the hippocampus, which is a central part of the brain for cognitive function, and that this also results in a diminished capacity to learn how to navigate in various spatial tests. Spatial memory is the type of memory that is used to navigate according to visual cues. This is a function that has been localized to the special brain area called the hippocampus. When you want to test this memory, you use visual cues in a room where the animal first has to learn to know the visual cues and how to navigate using the visual cues. We've looked more detailed into the pathology. It turns out that if you have vitamin C deficiency, your neurons have problems during their maturation process. Vitamin C clearly plays a role in the maturation process, and this is something that we're still looking into. This has also been done in guinea pigs, where we've taken some pregnant dams and subjected them to light vitamin C deficiency, and we have looked at the offspring. Interestingly, we found that the offspring had persistent volume reduction in the brain, suggesting retardation of brain development, particularly the hippocampus, but also very interestingly that this reduction or this retardment of development could not be reversed by postnatal repletion. That means if you give vitamin C to the babies after they're born, the damage inflicted during pregnancy was not reversed. So this looks like some kind of irreversible brain damage inflicted by marginal vitamin C deficiency. And obviously, if this can be translated into humans, it's a very severe problem that probably at some point should end up in some kind of recommendation to pregnant women.
What's the state of evidence regarding vitamin C dietary supplements?
It's very difficult to make randomized controlled trials to study the effect of vitamin C deficiency. And a couple of years back, I wrote a big review on the lessons that we have learned from the many randomized controlled trials that already exists on this particular compound. Problem is that, as was pointed out by Bruce Ames and many others, that randomized controlled trials is the gold standard for testing the efficacy of a drug. One of the major differences between micronutrients and drugs is that most drugs are readily excreted from the body by a variety of mechanisms, while nutrients are retained in the body, and therefore they have a completely different pharmacokinetics, which is the term that we use to describe how compounds are absorbed, distributed, and excreted and metabolized in the body. So randomized controlled trials is not an optimal choice, and moreover, many of the trials suffer some design flaws that, in my opinion, makes them less likely to be a good basis for recommendations to humans, and certainly to evaluate the efficacy of supplementation of vitamin C. So, in my view, what would be most interesting would be to see some well-designed randomized controlled trials where you actually recruit people that are deficient in vitamin C. Because the problem with vitamin C, as many other micronutrients, is that if you're sufficient in vitamin C already, you basically excrete the surplus. So if you give people supplementation and they already have what they need, they will not benefit. Unfortunately, none of the major randomized controlled trials of vitamin C have actually recruited people that were deficient in vitamin C, which is one of the reasons why we have really no idea if supplementation works if you're a high-risk individual. So those are some of the things that I would like to see. Turning into recommendations, I think that there is a compelling amount of evidence from epidemiological studies, that means cross-sectional population studies, where you have not been able to establish causality, but still you can see that there is well-established associations between vitamin C deficiency and the risk of developing cardiovascular disease, for instance, or some types of cancers, and overall mortality. And I think when you compare that to the risk of taking vitamin C as a supplement, then the sort of the benefit to harm ratio becomes very favorable, because there's really no risk in contrast to many other micronutrients. I think you could say that vitamin C is probably the safest. Even large doses are readily excreted if you get too much of it, and there are, to my knowledge, no important side effects of taking too much vitamin C. So normally you would say that an upper limit of between 1 or 2 gram would be completely safe, and a recommended amount of between 200 and 400 milligrams per day would probably be well within reach if you had a healthy and balanced diet. The current recommendation is between 60 to 110 milligrams per day, depending on the country. And for some people, that may just not be enough to bring your plasma concentration up to a reasonable number. But still, we do need some better clinical studies to establish a causal relationship between vitamin C deficiency and disease.
Food Today, science-based information on food, nutrition, and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council.